Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Mitt Romney's latest gaffes at a fundraiser in Jerusalem on Monday, where he said that the disparity in wealth between Israelis and Palestinians was due to cultural differences, prompting the Palestinian Authority to decry his remarks as a racist statement. A former legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team at the Annapolis bilateral peace talks in 2008 and a senior policy advisor to the Commissioner General of the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency, Laila Halal, joins us to discuss the remarks and Romney's factual inaccuracies as well. Then we'll discuss the U.S. Senate report out today following a two-year investigation into for-profit colleges that documents exorbitant tuition, deceptive marketing, and abysmal student outcomes, which are the norm in an industry almost entirely subsidized by the taxpayer. Deanne Lunan, the director of the Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project at the National Consumer Law Center, joins us to discuss a $32 billion a year racket funded by taxpayers that uses the GI Bill to rip off minority students and vets, leaving them with crippling debt and worthless diplomas. Then finally, we'll investigate the riots in Anaheim, California, a majority Latino community that has no Latino representation on the city council, with Latinos making up less than a quarter of the police force whose officers were involved in recent shootings of Latinos that sparked the ongoing protests. Martin Lopez, a community and labor organizer, and Eric Altman, the executive director of the Orange County Community Organized for Responsible Development, join us to discuss the lack of majority representation in this troubled community. Joining us now is Laila Halal, who is the co-director of the New America Foundation Middle East Task Force. Previously, she served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiations Department and advised the Palestinian Constitutional Committee during the drafting of the Basic Law. She acted as an external advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team as part of the Annapolis bilateral peace talks of 2008 and was a senior policy advisor to the Commissioner General of the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency and a visiting fellow and instructor at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laila Halal.
Thank you for having me.
And I imagine as a Palestinian you were quite struck by Mitt Romney's remarks that were unusual in themselves, since no U.S. presidential candidate has ever held a fundraiser in Israel. But in his remarks to this selective group of largely American billionaires, he mentioned that the disparity in wealth between the GDPs of the Palestinians and Israelis, quoting him, as you come here and see the GDP per capita, for instance, in Israel, which is about $21,000, compare that with the GDP per capita just across the areas managed by the Palestinian Authority, which is more like $10,000 per capita, you notice such a dramatically stark difference in economic vitality. And in referring to a book called The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, he went on to say, if you could learn anything from the economic history of the world, it's this: culture makes all the difference. And as I come here and look out over this city and consider the accomplishments of the people to this nation, I recognize the power of at least culture and a few other things and the hand of providence in selecting this place, Israel. Now, that prompted the spokesperson for the Palestinian Authority, Saeb Erekat, to refer to these remarks as being racist. What's your response, Laila Halal?
Well, Romney was, as you said, on a fundraising and political vote-gathering trip to Israel, and he made several mistakes and faux pas, if you will, during his visit. The first and most controversial was this reference to the economic disparity between Israel and the Palestinians, and attributing that difference to culture and the hand of providence. Now, the first point is that he used the wrong numbers in referencing the disparity. There is a great disparity between the economic situation of the Palestinians and the Israelis. Mitt Romney wrongly cited the difference as being between a per capita of 21,000 to 10,000 of the Palestinians, as you referenced. But those numbers are wrong. The right numbers, as we take from the World Bank that studies the Palestinian economy regularly and the Israeli economy regularly, is that The GDP of Israel is 31,000 and it's 1,500 for the Palestinians. That is a much greater disparity, but irrespective of that, the notion that you would attribute the difference to culture it belies the facts on the ground and is a racist notion to say that culture is responsible for economic differences. And by the way, he also compared the U.S. and Mexico and analogized the disparities between the U.S. and Mexico to also make his point that culture is the reason for one country's economic strength versus another's relative impoverishment. But just to sort of elaborate a bit on the disparities between Israel and the Palestinian territories is that the Palestinian territories are under military occupation. And as recognized by the World Bank just last week, the restrictions on movement and trade that the government of Israel places on the Palestinians is precisely responsible for Palestinians' economic stunting. And Mitt Romney completely brushed over this fact, and precisely he didn't even mention the Palestinians, nor did he take into account the occupation.
Well, it sounds like, though, that he managed to not just offend the Palestinians, but also offend the Mexicans. I wasn't aware that this was a double-barreled gaffe, if you will.
Well, exactly. And perhaps it shows more about Mitt Romney's inability to sort of realize who he's insulting and offending in one big sweep. So very, very disconcerting. But Mitt Romney also made a faux pas when he criticized or broke away from Obama's foreign policy or the U.S. foreign policy, generally speaking, on foreign soil. There's sort of a protocol that presidential candidates adhere to when they're visiting foreign countries, and that they don't break with the foreign policy of the United States. And Mitt Romney did that when he took issue with Obama's approach on Iran. Obama's policy is to essentially say that Iran should be stopped from developing a nuclear weapon. And Romney said, adhering to the Israeli position, that Iran should be stopped from developing the capability of developing a nuclear weapon. So he also broke ranks in his other talk during this visit. Well, and then his aide also made comments that Israel has the right to unilaterally attack Iran, whereas Obama has emphasized diplomacy and sanctions as a first step, not taking the possibility of force off the table. But right now, the Obama administration is pursuing a platform of diplomacy and sanctions in order to avoid an attack on Iran, which could unleash a great havoc in the region, and which is in no one's favor. So that was another error of Romney. And in fact, Romney had to indirectly and softly correct the statements of his aide. So we have to really wonder to what extent Mitt Romney is getting good advice in terms of his foreign policy, developing his foreign policy and factoring his foreign policy. And also in terms of, you know, what is Mitt Romney's goal? What was his goals in going to Israel? Was it to represent the U.S. or was it just to drum up support for his own campaign?
Again, I'm speaking with Laila Halal, who is a co-director of the New America Foundation Middle East Task Force, and previously she served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiating Department and advisor Palestinian Constitutional Committee during the drafting of the Basic Law and was an external advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team as part of the Annapolis bilateral peace talks of 2008, and was a senior policy advisor to the Commissioner General of UN Palestinian Refugee Agency and a visiting fellow and instructor at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. We're talking about Mitt Romney's statements on Monday morning at a breakfast fundraiser at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, before a group of largely American, wealthy American billionaires, talking about the so-called cultural differences between explaining the economic disparity between Israel and Palestine as having a cultural component, which prompted the aide to the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Saeb Erekat, to suggest that this is a racist statement. Saeb Erekat also went on to say that Romney also lacks knowledge about the Israelis themselves. I have not heard any Israeli official speak about cultural superiority. Have you, Lila?
No, in fact, I don't think that the Israelis would necessarily attribute their economic success to cultural superiority. In fact, Israel's cultural vitality is often attributed to entrepreneurship and to the expansion of the economy and to its strength in developing innovative technology, and the relationship between the diaspora and the Israeli citizenry. So the Jewish diaspora and the Israeli citizenry. So I think, there are very specific reasons why the Israeli economy is successful. And again, we can compare the situation of the Palestinians. For instance, a Palestinian American or American of Palestinian origin who is owns a tech company in Silicon Valley, if he or she wants to go to the occupied Palestinian territories and open up and develop a branch of the IT business in the territories, in the spirit of entrepreneurship, he or she would be prevented from entering Israel, most likely at the airport of Ben Gurion, or even at the Jordanian bridge crossing, because he or she is of Palestinian origin. So the ability of Palestinians to make links internationally, the Palestinians are a diasporic people and the quite successful people internationally, and the ability of the Palestinians to bring their wealth and to develop the private sector in the territories is limited by these kinds of restrictions. And if you take the time to go through things like the World Bank report, you realize that the Palestinian economy is very dependent on the service sector. And due to the restrictions on the ground, have been unable to develop sustainable, productive parts of the economy. For instance, 60% of the West Bank is classified as Area C, and is off limits to Palestinians. So that means natural resources, manufacturing potential areas are off limits to the Palestinians. So there's really a host of restrictions that are unrelated to culture that certainly explain the Palestinian economic struggles, but also I don't, as you said, think that the Israelis would want to attribute their own successes to just culture or the hand of God.
Providence. Well, Lila Hilal, my understanding is that just to sort of step back a moment, that you mentioned who's giving Romney advice. Well, we all know it's the neoconservatives, the people who brought us the Iraq War. His spokesperson in Israel, of course, is Dan Senor, whose sister runs AIPAC in Israel. And they're largely all of the big foreign policy advisors, the rest of the team of people like John Bolton, Elliot Abrahams, all of the people that, as I say, brought us the Iraq War. But just in terms of a little bit of a reality check, Israel, of course, receives the greatest amount of foreign aid that the United States gives to any country in the world. And Obama just upped that by 70 million just a couple of days ago on the eve of Romney's trip, obviously trying to compete a little bit there for the pro-Israel vote. Israel basically got most of the water, all the best land. These Palestinians have not only then under military occupation, they have to pay for their utilities, don't they, from Israel. They're essentially the idea or the lack of acknowledgement of how much the occupation cripples the Palestinian economy and their potential is, you know, fairly callous, I think, for anybody, let alone somebody that apparently wants to be president of the United States.
Well, it is very disconcerting that someone would speak with such a lack of knowledge and indifference to the situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's a major strategic priority of the U.S. to be able to broker some kind of peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's always been the priority, and it is recognized from the Defense Department to the State Department to all sectors of government to even the Congress that peace between Israelis and Palestinians is an important strategic objective to have stability in the Middle East. And so the question arises as to whether or not Mitt Romney is able to play a role in which he could actually serve that a strategic objective. I mean, certainly after this trip, Palestinians and many people who are thoughtful and thinking about the role of the U.S. will question whether or not Mitt Romney could serve as an honest broker in the relationship between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And just here, I would also note that, you know, Mitt Romney again spoke out against the policy, took a difference with the long stated bipartisan policy of the U.S. when he said that he recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The east side of Jerusalem is annexed territory by Israel. And no country in the world recognizes East Jerusalem as part of the capital of Israel. In fact, no one recognizes Jerusalem per se as the capital of Israel. This question is one that needs to be resolved politically, and that's the position of multiple Republican and Democratic administrations in the U.S., and Mitt Romney seems to have ignored that reality. So, again, the question is, can he be an honest broker, and can he serve U.S. interests in the Middle East effectively?
Sure. Well, I'm just in closing, I have to wrap it up here, Lila. But the guy that he was sitting next to at the fundraiser, Sheldon Adelson, along with most of his friends, are dedicated to the settlement movement. They're the ones who fund the settlement movement. So Mitt Romney, if he were to become president of the United States, would, I think, pretty clearly change the longstanding U.S. policy on settlements.
It's quite a possibility.
It's a little hard to believe. It's a little hard to believe all of this is happening, but this man actually has a fairly good chance of becoming president of the United States. So I thank you for joining us, Lila Halal.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with Lila Halal, who's the co-director of the New America Foundation Middle East Task Force. Previously, she served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiating Department and advised the Palestinian Constitutional Committee during the drafting of the Basic Law. She acted as an external advisor to the Palestinian Negotiating Team as part of the Annapolis Bilateral Peace Talks of 2008 and was a senior policy advisor to the Commissioner General of the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency and a visiting fellow and instructor at the Refugee Studies Center at Oxford University. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Senate report released today on the for-profit college racket.
was hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Deanne Lunan, who's an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of its Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She assists attorneys representing low-income consumers and teaches consumer law to legal services, private consumer attorneys, and other advocates. She's the author of the center's publication, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as a later study, The Student Loan Default Trap. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deanne Lunan.
Thanks so much.
And of course, on Monday, Senator Harkin's Senate committee came out with its report after a 2-year investigation. That's the so-called HELP Committee of the United States Senate, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. This is a really damning report by any measure, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Extremely troubling.
And I guess since you've been monitoring this industry for some time, you're not entirely surprised. But do you think that the American public are going to wake up to this problem?
Well, I sure hope so. I think that it shows that it's not just a few bad apples, which is often what the industry says, but there's rampant fraud and abuse in the for-profit sector.
Well, the taxpayers spend $32 billion a year to operate these for-profit colleges, and the majority of the students they enroll leave without a degree, half of them within 4 months. The report accuses this for-profit college industry of having exorbitant tuition fees, aggressive recruiting practices, abysmal student outcomes, taxpayer dollars spent on marketing and pocketed as profits, and regulatory evasion and manipulation. And went on to say that these practices are the norm and are systemic in the industry. It's fairly hard to find any defense. What do you think will be the next stage in terms of this study having some legislative outcome or some real impact on the problems that this study reveals?
Well, a lot of it's a matter of political will in Congress and also in the administration to take some real action, both in terms of policy reform and also to enforce the existing laws so that the laws on the books are real hammers for the people who deserve to be hammered. So it's not just a matter of passing new laws. There are ways that both states and the federal government can do some enforcement and make sure that the schools are accountable.
Well, given some of the findings, that you know, the priorities of these colleges, and many of which now are on Wall Street and are owned by private equity firms, the colleges that this report studied had a total of 32,496 recruiters compared to 3,512 staff members, meaning teachers. I mean, that's an amazing disproportion of recruiters as opposed to teachers.
Right. I mean, I think that's one of the main problems is this is really about growth and getting students in the door. It's an industry that's almost entirely dependent on federal dollars for the students to pay for the supposed educations. So hopefully this will pull back the curtain and let us see what's really going on. It's not that there can't be flexibility in education. It's not that everybody has to go to a traditional 4-year school. There should be flexibility, but there also needs to be accountability.
Again, I'm speaking with Deanne Lunan, who is an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of the Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She's the author of the center's publication, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as the latest study out, The Student Loan Default Trap. Now, in terms of the student loan default trap, the Harkin report that came out on Monday talked about how these for-profit colleges in effect disguise the default, and many of the for-profit colleges try to move students having trouble with repayment into deferral or forbearance until they are past the years that the government monitors. Explain to me that loophole and how to close it.
Well, there is what's called the official default rate or the cohort default rate, and those are the statistics that we usually see about what the default rate is by sector in the federal loan programs. And that default rate only tracks borrowers for a short period of time after they leave school or after they graduate. So what the schools try to do in many cases is make their numbers look better by placing borrowers into the shortest term options like forbearances, which aren't necessarily the best options for the borrowers, but it allows them to move from forbearance to forbearance during that period that they're tracked. And that way, the default rate doesn't look as bad as it should if it truly reflected the number of borrowers who are in default or who aren't able to repay. And the schools do that because if their default rates are too high, they potentially face sanctions.
Well, the report out on Monday from Senator Harkin's committee, the U.S. Senate's Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, this after a two-year investigation into for-profit colleges, mentioned, for example, how a Westwood College recruiter, and frankly, I've never heard of Westwood College, but here in Los Angeles, of course, UCLA is in the suburb of Westwood, so I guess it has some patina to it, that name. They were told that the cost, prospective students were told that the cost was $4,800 per term, but what they weren't told was that this involves 5 to 6 terms a year rather than the usual 2 to 3. I mean, that seems like flagrant trickery.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one example of a lot of blatant misrepresentations at the front end when they're trying to bring the students into the door. And then the default rate statistic that you mentioned shows how borrowers are harmed when they don't get the proper outcomes, they don't complete, they don't get jobs as promised, and they're not able to repay the loans. It's even more important because the consequences of being in default on federal student loans are so dire, and people face potentially having their tax refunds taken with no time limit. The government can literally come after them forever.
But the point here is, of course, is that these for-profit colleges find ways to have these student loans funneled through them. Why not have the government loan directly to the students? Wasn't that what the original Pell Grants were supposed to be about?
Well, the Pell Grants also go through the schools, and so frankly, there's problems in the Pell Grant program too. It's just that it's a problem for taxpayers in the sense that there's a lot of dollars going to those schools, but the students aren't stuck with the debt because those are grants as opposed to loans. So one thing to do would be to look at alternative ways to disperse the money, but really the problem is that the schools themselves have to be accountable for their outcomes. Because even if the money goes directly to the schools, if the student doesn't succeed, doesn't get the education that's promised, and still isn't able to repay the loan, they're going to be in trouble regardless of what the source of the loan was.
Well, the report indicates, for example, Deanne Loon and the Apollo Group, which operates the University of Phoenix, which is the largest for-profit college, they got $1.2 billion in Pell Grants in 2010 and 2011, which is up from $24 million only a decade earlier. And on top of that, Apollo got $210 million more in benefits under the post-9/11 GI Bill. So explain to us how these for-profit colleges now are double-dipping. Not only do they get the federal student loan money, upon which most of their students default, but they also apparently have got their hooks into the GI Bill.
Yeah, no, the industry's grown astronomically, and a lot of that has to do with the Wall Street dollars and the fact that a lot of these companies are publicly funded now. But a lot of it has to do with the demand for higher education and the lack of public support for a lot of the public sector institutions. So there are a lot of people who are seeking education and don't have a place to go. They're recruited very heavily by these schools. They believe the promises from these schools. And so a lot more students are signing up for those schools. And as the sector grows, so does the federal dollars that flows to it.
Yeah, but the only reason, as far as I can tell, that the students believe this is that they are able to advertise on television. I see, for example, something called Capella, another one of these new shingles, advertising all the time. Whenever I see these ads for these for-profit colleges, I have to pinch myself and realize that that is taxpayer dollars that are doing this. So the taxpayer is paying these companies who pay their executives up to $7.3 million in the case of the chief executive of Strayer Education, who also made $41 million in 2009 from stock options. These companies, the reason they're able to recruit these students is through the deceptive advertising that the taxpayer pays for God's sake.
No, absolutely. I mean, and that's the saddest part of all this. But the point is that there are students or young people and, frankly, people of all ages who are looking to go to school and don't necessarily have options in the traditional four-year sector. And so there is that demand. The point is that we want that demand to be met with quality educations and not to be met with these false promises.
Again, I'm speaking with Deanne Lunan, who's an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of the Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She's the author of the center's publication, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as the latest study, The Student Loan Default Trap. So the study that's been released Monday from the United States Senate's Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which is culminating a two-year-long investigation into the for-profit college industry. Among the 30 companies that they looked into, an average of 22.4% of the revenues, that's 90% of which are taxpayer money, I might add, 22.4% of the revenues went to marketing and recruiting, 19.4% to profits, and 17.7% to instruction. So you get the impression that they're only colleges in name, that's the lowest priority.
Right, and that's, again, the tragedy of all this is that this is often a very vulnerable population who isn't necessarily served in all cases by the public sector or by the traditional schools. They're looking to better themselves through education, and the product that's being sold is not an education.
So what went on with this committee in terms of, they're trying to sort of suggest that this is some partisan thing on the part of the Democrats? I mean, is there anybody challenging these findings? Is anybody coming up with any way to suggest that there's anything in this report that's not true?
No, it's a political smokescreen, frankly. It's become a partisan battle when really this is an objective investigation. In general, the opponents are not citing the facts. They're either just coming up with excuses or they're claiming that the information is biased because some of the information, for example, the sources for it were short sellers on Wall Street. And because they were shorting the industry, they had a conflict of interest. But they're not disputing the actual information.
So in terms of how this came about, Deanne Lunan, it must have a lot to do with the fact that the Congress has enabled this since it's all taxpayer money. So then you have to ask yourself, well, how did the Congress enable this? And apparently that kind of disgrace is a bipartisan one, even though the Republicans on the committee rejected the findings, even though they couldn't find anything wrong with the actual report. It's clear the Republicans are supporting these for-profit colleges, but I believe they also get support from Democrats as well.
Absolutely. You know, it's not everybody on both sides of the aisle who is to blame, but in the sense of campaign contributions and the way that this industry has bought a lot of politicians, that's happened on both sides of the aisle.
So the report says that the companies that examined spent $8 million on lobbying in 2010 and another $8 million in the first 9 months of 2011. So that's what they do. They spend $8 million a year, roughly, on lobbying, and they get back $32 billion, right?
I mean, right. It's a good investment for them.
And a tragic investment for these students. That's the part of it that I find heartbreaking.
Absolutely. It shatters their dreams, it shatters their lives, and those are the clients who we work with. And again, these are people who are trying to better themselves, better their lives through education. That's what they think they're buying.
So describe what it's like with the clients that you have Deanne Lunan at the National Consumer Law Center, where she's the director of the Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. Describe the people who come into your door, the problems they have, and more importantly, you know, what can be done about it?
So most of the people we see are what they call non-traditional students, meaning that they tend to be a little bit older. In some cases, that means just more than 25, but they don't fit the profile of a young 18-year-old who's a dependent, maybe living with parents and looking at a four-year school. A lot of these clients that we have already been to school before and didn't finish for various reasons and are now trying to go back. Most of them have their own dependents, and a lot of them are actually working while they're going to school. In a lot of cases, they're doing their best to move up to a better job. A lot of them are working in low-wage jobs or not working at all. So all of these things are sort of coming together, and they're hearing the social message, the society message out there, which I think is a good message, that if you go get more education, you're more likely to succeed. Sometimes they're trying to educate themselves for a specific career. Sometimes it's something more general than that. But that's the profile. And then, unfortunately, by the time we see them, they've already been to the school. In most cases, they did not complete the program because it was an inferior program or because the promises that were made were not true and they weren't able to get what they thought they were going to get. They come to us because they're struggling to repay the student loan debt, which is the burden that's left that they have left. Then they don't have the degree or the certificate or anything else that's actually going to move them forward financially.
Well, just in closing, Deanne Lunan, the students at for-profit colleges make up 13% of the nation's college enrollment, but they account for 47% of the defaults on loans. And about 96% of students at for-profit colleges take out loans, compared with 13% at community colleges and 48% at four-year public universities. So there you have this outrageous comparison. And what I don't understand is why the taxpayer, because of corruption in Congress, is spending $32 billion a year on these for-profit colleges who've essentially found a way to simply steal from the Treasury. Why not invest this money in the community colleges and in public universities? Here in the state of California, they're eviscerating the University of California system, which is one of the best in the world, and they're also eviscerating the community college system because of the state budget crunch.
Absolutely. There needs to be more public investment in education, and we need to do right by these student borrowers. I mean, the industry cynically says these are at-risk borrowers, so of course a lot of them don't succeed. And that's the most cynical argument of all. They can succeed. These students who are at risk, non-traditional students, they can succeed, but they deserve the same kind of quality of education as other student borrowers are getting.
So do you think that this report will get some traction and the taxpayer will realize, that on the one hand, they're watching the state of California, for example, cut funds from public education. On the other hand, there's an open trough here at the federal treasury that these crooks on Wall Street and others are just stealing money from. I mean, it's pretty glaring, isn't it?
You would hope so, and it certainly should get the attention, but it's mostly become sort of a political football and a bipartisan bickering. But we hope that everyone can rally around both caring for the students themselves, but also caring for the incredible waste of taxpayer dollars.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Deanne Lunan.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Deanne Lunan, who's an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of its Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She assists attorneys representing low-income consumers and teaches consumer law to legal services, private consumer attorneys, and other advocates. She's the author of the Center's publication, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as the latest study, The Student Loan Default Trap. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the riots in nearby Anaheim and the lack of representation for the majority of Latinos in the community.
All that diamond dust blowing up your heart.
Deals made too cold, ideas in decline. Rise of the lost, yeah. Hey, here we stand, slave to networks, master plans. Swags the brand, open a can. Chains off still, yeah, I never ran. But who do you think you are?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Martin Lopez and Eric Altman. Martin Lopez is an Anaheim neighborhood leader and recording secretary of Unite Here, Local 11. He has lived in Anaheim for 7 years, worked there for 22 years, and has witnessed directly the lack of political representation for Anaheim's Latino majority. And Eric Altman is Executive Director of Orange County Communities Organized for Responsible Development. Previously, he spent 15 years as a leader for Unite Here Strategic Affairs Department, working to build one of the labor movement's most respected research and strategic campaign operations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Lopez and Eric Altman.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak.
And let me begin with you, Martin. The LA Times recently wrote an editorial that the city of Anaheim must trace the source of the anger among local Latinos to the fact that the city council, whose four members are all elected on citywide votes, are basically all white, and they dilute the Latino citizens' voting power. Is that really at the heart of the frustration in the Latino community that there's no representation on the council, and less than a quarter of the police force are Latino?
Yeah, we believe that has a lot to do with it. I mean, the fact that there is only four city councils, and the majority of them living in kind of the rich areas, which is Anaheim Hills, while our communities are growing in the center and east west side of our city. And by not having a Latino representative or by not having any representation whatsoever, regardless.
But Latinos make up more than half of Anaheim's residents and a third of the registered voters. So what's the percentage of registered voters then? Is that a normal percent, or could there be even more potential voters there on the Latino side?
Well, at this point, it's a third of the city is actually registered to vote within the Latinos. I'm sure that there's a lot more Latinos that need to be registered to vote. But at this point, I mean, in 2006, one of the city council elections, one of the Latino of our choice, if he got the most Latino votes, although he wasn't able to win because of the current electorate structure in our city. So if you're Latino and you are not and you don't have wealth, all this money, you're not going to be able to get elected.
So let me turn to Eric Altman, the executive director of the Orange County Communities Organized for Responsible Development. Anaheim is the largest city in California to elect its council at large. By contrast, more than 83% of large U.S. cities use district elections. Obviously, this is a situation you want to change, right?
Well, I think it's a real issue. I mean, this is the city has a.
Sorry, I lost you there. Are you there, Eric? Did we leave you? Lose you?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Very badly. Yeah. Just can you answer that question? So maybe we'll have to call you back because it's. Go ahead.
Let me try again.
Yeah.
So what I was going to say is that. Is that the election system that Anaheim has, this that large system, is it's decades old, really. It dates from a time when the city was very homogenous and very small. And this city has transformed tremendously over the past, you know, over the past several decades. It's the majority, as you said, is Latino. There are also many other diverse communities. There's a large and growing Arab and Muslim community, a large Filipino and Asian Pacific Islander community, the neighborhoods themselves are very different. You have Anaheim Hills, a wealthy neighborhood. In one part of town, you have the Colony, which is a historic neighborhood. In another part of town, you have, you know, neighborhoods where there are essentially tenements full of resort workers and others in different part of town. This all can't be represented by, you know, by three council members and a mayor living in Anaheim Hills and another council member living in one part of town. I mean, it's just not possible.
Well, we can hear you, but I must say this, the cell is very tinny. So if there's any way you can improve the signal, let me turn to Martin Lopez for a minute. Walk us through, Martin, the events that led up to these riots and demonstrations that have taken place. And then just yesterday, there was an attempt on the part of some people to march towards Disneyland, and they were met by a phalanx of very highly militarized police, sending a clear signal that hands off the Magic Kingdom, you know. I take it the spark for these series of demonstrations was the police shooting on July the 21st of Manuel Diaz.
Right. I mean, our communities are upset. They're really angry. And I was witness on last Tuesday city council meeting with several hundreds of people actually came to city council and wanted to express their anger and wanted to ask for solutions to the shootings. And we all know that this is as a result of lack of a government representation, but they weren't given that opportunity and therefore had no other way to express their anger but to go out to the streets. I mean, we don't like that, but that's just going out of hand by the current city council.
So the shooting of Manuel Diaz was then followed by the shooting of Joel Acevedo. Now, in both cases, both Manuel Diaz and now apparently Joel Acevedo fired at police officers during a foot chase. So give us a sense of how these two people are supposed to be gang members, right?
Well, you know, these two areas are actually the two areas where several neighborhood residents have actually come to city council in months past and asked for help through bringing more resources to the city, whether it's more police, whether it's bringing some community centers, whether it's bring programs and complain about the issues that are going on in those are communities that are very poor. So the response that the city has given is just sending police officers and threaten the community and shoot at people just perhaps by their appearance.
So in other words, you're saying that the community wanted protection from the gangs, but instead that's the part of I don't understand, that the rallying around gang members who are a problem, aren't they?
Well, I mean, what are you going to do, kill everyone that appears to be a gang member?
No, I certainly don't think that's a good idea. I'm just saying that it's one thing to protest injustice and the lack of representation, which seems in this case to be flagrant, but it's another thing, to shoot at a cop. That's not exactly something that's defensible, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, what I'm saying is that the solutions, we're proposing a solution, and the solution is that those areas lack representation. City Council needs to look at those areas with solutions, not with not to attack them, not to threatening situations, but to help work with them. And that's what we haven't seen.
So is there, Eric, are we still with you? Eric Altman, Executive Director of Orange County Community Organized for Responsible Development. So is there, as well as getting, you know, some democratic representation, I mean, we talk about majority rule in this country and majority rule in the rights of minorities, but in this case, the Latino majority are getting shafted on both counts. As minorities, they don't seem to have any rights, but they are actually a majority. I mean, that's the part of it that's extraordinary.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why you need to go to extraordinary remedies like the California Voting Rights Act, which does, in which was designed to address situations just like this, to change these at-large systems, which dilute the voting power of protected groups by shifting to the more, you know, sort of traditionally democratic route of representative democracy.
So what about the representation on the police force? You've got apparently about 22% of the officers, the sworn officers, are Latino. Is there anything being done to make them more representative of the majority of the community?
I don't know if there is or is not, but I think the way that I would come at that question is this. I mean, if you have a city council that is actually representative of the entire community, then you can look at all kinds of things like that. There are probably a lot of reforms that need to happen in the police department. People talk about the composition of the force. People talk about community policing initiatives. People talk about, you know, independent civilian police commissions, all these kinds of things. And those may very well be solutions or part of a solution to what's going on in Anaheim. But all of those things, at the end of the day, the buck stops at the city council. And if the city council is made up of folks that don't understand and don't reflect the entire city, then they're not going to be able to make those decisions, no matter how hard they might try. They're not going to be able to make those decisions in a way that benefits everybody and really gets to the root of the problems. And when you add in the fact that so much of the way that Anaheim is governed and so many of the city's priorities revolve around the resort industry and what the resort industry wants and needs, it really tends to squeeze out the priorities and the needs of neighborhoods throughout the city. And so I just don't think you can tackle questions of what kind of reform is needed in the police department if you don't have the ultimate authority decision maker here, the city council, inclusive of and incorporating voices from around the city. It's just not possible.
So, Martin Lopez, with the Anaheim Neighborhood Leader and recording Secretary of Unite here, Local 11, given what Eric's just told us, it seems like the priority here has to be to change, to make this city council respond to the majority of the electorate. How do you go about that? I mean, clearly, if you got a entrenched historical kind of white privilege operating there, they're not going to give it up. What kind of legal measures are there? How can you change the system from the citywide representation to community-wide representation?
Right. Well, at this point, there's been a lawsuit filed by three residents of Anaheim, which I strongly support, in violation of the California Voting Rights Act that establishes that every single community or ethnicity has the right to have a representation or given the opportunity to elect the council members of their choice, which has been denied to the Latino community in the last few decades.
So is this simply that is the only course? You've got angry people in the street. What do you say to the angry people in the street? We're going to wait for the courts to decide this?
Well, we're going to continue coming to City Council and address and hope that they, for the well-being of the city, the benefit of our city, they make they settle on this and they agree that this is something that is required, that it requires immediate attention. And if not, we go to the courts. But yeah, in the meantime, we need to organize our communities and doing things in a civilized way. While we continue fighting, I think that our voices, we can make our voices be heard without violence.
Yeah,
I could jump in on that.
Sure, question. Eric, go ahead.
You know, the city council could settle that lawsuit today if they wanted to. I mean, they could settle this right now and come to a solution that was workable for the community, that was negotiated between the community and the council members. They could settle this today and implement district elections. And why they're not doing that, particularly when we see, you know, over these past 9 or 10 days, what's going on in the city, why they are not doing that, why they are not settling that lawsuit like right now is a complete mystery to me. I mean, that to me is just foot dragging and adherence to a status quo that so very clearly is not working for everybody in the city. And ultimately, it's going to be, I mean, this kind of disturbance is bad for everybody in the long run. You know, this city has worked very hard to cultivate an image, whether it's the image of the happiest place on earth or, you know, to use their own jargon, they want to be freedom friendly, they want to be a kind city, all these things that have been put forward by this city council and the resort industry. All of those images cannot survive if there is not action taken right now. And the quickest course of action is settle this lawsuit today.
Yeah, but you're asking the four members of the white, traditional white privileged elite to give up their own power, aren't you?
Well, I think that ultimately, and first of all, they're not all white, by the way. They're not all Anglos. And so there's definitely some class issues here in addition to race and ethnicity. But we're asking them to do what they were elected to do, which is to represent the people of Anaheim. Sure, are they going to face pressure from Anaheim Hills and from the resort not to do that? They probably will face pressure. But at the end of the day, that's a lot better than having a court decide and implement, right?
Sure.
And it's a lot better than having a divisive debate within the city for months and months and years and years and years. I mean, if they really are responsible to the city, they should act now. And that would be in the best interest of everybody.
Well, let me just have a quick last word from Martin Lopez. I mean, it seems to me, I recall that B1 Bob Dornan, one of the most right-wing guys in Congress, used to represent this area. Now it's Loretta Sanchez, isn't it? So there's indications that things can change.
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So
it's just not Anaheim, but several cities around in Orange County.
Right. So at the end of the day, eventually reality catches up, right?
Correct. And we want these guys to be able to understand that this needs to the sooner it takes place,
sooner
they resolve this, the less issues that we're going to continue having.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Martin Lopez, again, the Anaheim Neighborhood Leader and Recording Secretary of Unite Here, Local 11, and Eric Altman, the Executive Director of Orange County Communities Organized for Responsible Development. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Christian Vasquez. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.